And it's time for a little bit of the Olympic spirit. Let's get started with the Running Anthropologist episode number 56. Thanks so much for being here. Today we have a special treat with U.S. track and field coach Gary Aldrich. Just fresh off his silver and gold medal coaching, among other outstanding athletes, he coaches full-time at Carnegie Mellon, but has been on a lot of international coaching teams and then now got sent to the Olympics. He shares with us all about what it was like going to Tokyo, how he got there, what it was like in the International Olympic Village, and what it was like on the track. His enthusiasm is overflowing, and he has some awesome advice for young runners as well. Kind of tells us what it's like to transition from college to professional athlete, and some of the challenges that these Olympic athletes face in going to the Olympics and preparing for the Olympics. A little bit about COVID, how that affected things, but mostly just the Olympic spirit. Beautiful, round, big, throwing right at you. He was the throw coach for the track and field team, and I'll let him tell you all the rest, but thank you for joining us. Look forward to sharing. Let's get started. And I'd like to welcome Coach Gary Aldrich to the podcast. Super grateful to have you with us, just back from the Olympics, and to learn more about what it was like. Thanks for being willing to join us, Gary.
No, thank you, Mark. I really appreciate the opportunity that you're giving me to be here to hopefully share some of the experiences and answer some questions.
Yeah, it's so cool. I'm so excited. Obviously, all of us have the Olympic spirit, and we've been waiting so long, an extra year this time. I guess let's start at the beginning. How did you find out you'd be an Olympic coach? And kind of, you know, for people out there who maybe aren't coaching or don't know a lot about it, what kind of path did you follow to end up, going to the Olympics with Team USA?
Right. So basically what occurred was back in right around 2010, it was suggested to me by a friend that I should apply to be a coach for USA Track and Field on some of their international teams. And I was like, why? And he's like, well, because we think you'd do a great job. And so I was like, okay. And so I did that, and luckily I was chosen. I was chosen to be the men's throws coach for the NACAC under 23 team, which is the North American, Central American, Caribbean under 23 team. And so what occurs after you do that coaching stint, then the other staff members that are on that team with you and the athletes, they grade you on how you did. And so I ended up, thankfully, graded out pretty well. And so it was then encouraged for me to apply for another team. And that's when I was able to get the World Junior Championship team that was in Barcelona, Spain. And so it was an ongoing process, really, for quite a few years where I would apply for teams, be selected, you get graded. Obviously, I was very thankful that people thought I was doing what I should have been doing and aiding and making their experience the best that they could have. And so I also did World Indoor Championships, Pan Am Games, World Outdoor Championships, and that led to the Olympic opportunity.
Wow.
And so it was pretty, it's been a long road, but it's been an incredible, exciting, and I don't know if I want to say this caps it off, because, you know, obviously I think I want to do this again because it was such a great opportunity. And it was yet so very different this time because of everything going on with COVID. So I don't know if I experienced the Olympics as what the Olympics normally were. So I would love to see what that would be like, for sure.
Yeah, so Coach Aldridge, I failed to say you're the head coach at Carnegie Mellon University there, and you've been doing this for a long time, but really the last decade doing a lot of the international coaching stuff. A lot of people aren't aware that, you know, outside of college and outside of the Olympics, there's this like whole year-round training and world championships in track and field. What is that like? How do athletes get into that, you know, kind of becoming professional athletes in track and field?
Yeah, obviously it's one of those things where after they graduate from college and they've had some success at the collegiate level, they start making some of these international teams based off of how they finish at the USA Track and Field Championships, or like we just had in back in June, the Olympic Trials. And then from there, they make the decision on, are they going to do this for the rest of their life? Are they going to start making this their job, if you will? Mm-hmm. And obviously, as I tell kids that I'm recruiting, the chances of you making a life's living being a track athlete, it's pretty small. It's almost kind of like slim and none. Obviously I'm hoping they're picking Carnegie Mellon because of the academics that we are, being a world-leading institution in a number of different areas. And so it takes a, you know, very talented, very dedicated, very driven person to actually be able to make their living. So perfect example is right after the Olympics here, Ryan Krauser, Joe Kovacs, who finished 1-2 in the men's shot put, they're competing today at the Prefontaine Classic. And then as soon as that's over, they're flying to Europe.
Wow, never stops.
To different Diamond League competitions, things like that, where, again, depending on how they do, they'll start making money off of their performances, and that's where they're going to make their wages for the year and doing things like that. And so it's a ongoing process, but it's something that, again, there's certain event groups, say distance runners, who tend to get a little bit more exposure, or the sprinters, than what jumpers and throwers tend to get. But they're out there, they work daily to put themselves in a position where they can actually make money doing what they love, and that's, in our case, throwing far.
Yeah, that's amazing. You know, you don't really hear a lot of that side. People, of course, are really excited about the Olympics, but then things die down and you don't really hear a lot outside of a few running events about the year-to-year work that they put in. And like you said, there's a lot of risk and it's very low odds that they'll be able to do that for life. So that's really challenging for professional athletes.
Very much so.
Now,
you know, and
go ahead.
One of the things makes it even more impressive that they make a living off of doing something they love, because it's very much different than the professional leagues. We don't have a feeder system there. Lots of times they're doing this on a shoestring budget. I know there have been companies such as Dick's or Home Depot who have had special program for Olympic type athletes where they can work part time at those locations and still be able to do what they have to do to train. And companies like that are a huge, huge benefit for not only track athletes, but other Olympic-type sports that don't get that big-time recognition day-to-day like some of the professional sports do.
Yeah, putting myself inside the head of one of your, say, seniors, you know, early 20s, They want to be in the next Olympics, but they don't have the means to support themselves to train for it. So that kind of an alternative is what they have.
Yes, exactly. You know, and they do a lot of things, and there's a lot of part-time work, and it's not the easiest route to go, because they're looking at trying to find, you know, personal coaches, and that's going to cost money. They're looking for therapists and chiropractors and to help keep them healthy so that they can do the training, strength and conditioning. And that's why the program that USA Track and Field has out at Chula Vista with the Olympic Training Center is an incredible thing, where a number of our top athletes have lived there, and they're able to get those things so that they can train and live that lifestyle. And people like Ryan Krauser, Jill Kovacs, they went through that, and they did live in Chula Vista, and they were part of that Olympic Training Center. And so it's another thing that USA Track and Field and the USOPC are doing to aid our athletes in being the best that they can be.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, without something like that, it seems like, I mean, that's a tremendous service that really Track and Field is offering. And they live there year-round or most of the year and do training there?
Yes, exactly. And they live in dorms, or some of them, as they become a little bit more accomplished, they'll maybe get an apartment off of site, but they have the nutritionist, they have the food available there, they have the medical personnel there, they have coaching there as well that allows them to continue their growth and development.
Oh, that's fantastic. For a lot of these guys, obviously, for the majority of your team, I'm sure it was their first Olympics. And so that had a lot of build up to it, and a lot of uncertainty this year. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that, you know, what it was like going in and what it was like for the athletes going into the Tokyo Olympics.
Yeah, it was obviously over a year ago. There was a lot of uncertainty because, you know, COVID, you know, shut down the Olympics. And so we didn't know if it was going to go on, but the Japanese government and the Olympic Committee there, they definitely wanted to put it on, and they did an incredible job in hosting us, and they're hosting the Paralympics. I believe as we speak, the Paralympics have started there as well. And so they were really dedicated to actually putting this on. And even as early as, you know, January, there was still some uncertainty. Is this going to happen? And then, you know, we finally realized it was going to happen. And it was a incredible thing. You know, people have asked, you know, oh, did it, not having fans there, did it affect the meet? No. I think if you compare and see what world records and Olympic records and national records and personal best, it was still the most incredible track and field meet you could ever dream of seeing. And the athletes performed, and they did it at the highest level. And I'll be a little bit selfish. It was kind of cool not having everybody there, because I got a chance in whatever seat I wanted to watch the world's greatest track meet, you know? So me as a coach and a person who loves to film and watch what's going on, I had great seats to be able to do that sort of thing, a lot better than if there were thousands of people in the stadium, you know? So
yeah. No, that's one interesting thing I hadn't thought about, is that, you know, there were a lot of people in the stands, and they were the people that are really invested and care about the team, like yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So as the athletes and coaches, we were able to get in there and watch, and you know, we did that, and that was the thing that made it great.
Now, so you mentioned dorms earlier. I have to ask you, were the coaching staff in the same dorms as all the athletes from around the world? What was that like? You know, what was the environment like, and what kind of things did you did you experience in that community life outside of the track?
Yeah, it was, we basically were living in high-rise dorms. It was interesting. The rooms were small. Even for small, like I'm definitely a thrower. I'm 6'6", 260. So I'm definitely a thrower type person. But the rooms were small. The cardboard beds were pretty interesting. The itself was pretty amazing. And being here at Carnegie Mellon with so many mechanical engineers, I was lifting, and my roommate was Nat Page, who's down at Georgia Tech. He's the jumps and hurdles coach down there. Again, another engineering school. So we're looking at the design of the cardboard beds. It was the mattress that was the problem for me. The mattress was not very to my liking, but it was okay. But the bed itself was pretty ingenious, actually. But it was, a lot of that was the same as what we probably hear. We just had to wear masks. I know I'm a big baseball guy, so on a regular basis, I'd be downstairs in the lounge area, and some of the baseball team members were there, especially someone like Todd Frazier, who was actually playing with the Pirates earlier this year. So I got a chance to talk to them and see how things was going for them. And obviously they, that was one of the things I had hoped to go to, because I am such a big baseball fan, was to get to a Japanese USA baseball game, especially there in Japan with baseball being so big. And yet that was one of the things that we couldn't do that normally you could do. We were not allowed to go to any other sporting event except our own.
Ah, okay.
So people couldn't come and watch track. We couldn't go watch baseball. We couldn't go, watch a rugby seven or skateboarding or whatever the case might be. So that was one of the disappointing things.
No, but I didn't know that. Go ahead. Sorry.
It was one of the things that you still get a chance to meet and talk with them in the lounge area, and see how they were doing.
Yeah, no, that would be a neat thing, I think, too. One of the things that I have heard in athletes coming back is that there wasn't as much intermingling with the other delegations as perhaps in a normal year, and they kind of intentionally had the things set up that way. Did you find that to be the case among the track and field athletes as well?
Yeah, I think so, because they, in the dining hall, they had the petitions up so that, it was like you were in your own little block. And even if, like Nat Page and I went to dinner together, in between us was a plexiglass sheet. And so it made things a little bit harder, where you just didn't really kind of socialize in the cafeteria as much. There were still people, as you're walking around, people are still trading pins, trying to get pins from the different nations and things like that. But I think it was probably more limited than what you would have normally seen in a normal year. But as I've told people, it's still the Olympics. It was still the most amazing experience and opportunity I've ever been able to have in my professional career. It's something that I just hope I can do again.
You just can't kill that Olympic spirit, even with all the restrictions, right?
No way.
So on that topic, I did want to ask you, a lot of people ask and kind of wonder this kind of friendly rivalries between the delegations, maybe the big countries that are, like the Russia and the U.S. and the China. Did you sense some of that rivalry, that competition, even in the social interactions?
Yeah, there's, and we can kind of take it really. And I think the men's shot put is a great place to see that rivalry, because you have, Ryan and Joe for the U.S. and then there's Tom Waltz from New Zealand. And obviously they're the three best shot putters in the world. And they proved it once again. They finished the exact same way they did in Rio in 2016, with Brian and Joe going gold, silver, Tom getting the bronze. But Then you had in Doha the World Championships, and it was those threes again, just a little bit different with Joe winning.
Oh.
And, you know, so, but, excuse me, Tom, he lives and trains here in the United States for a number of weeks. I know he was just down in Athens, Georgia, training down there. And he is lived out in Arizona for a while. So these guys, they're all good friends with each other, even though that they, you know, compete against each other, and you can see it. And do they want to beat each other? Most definitely they want to beat each other. Even Ryan and Joe, they want to beat each other. But it's still that, and I think that's one of the things that's great about our sport, is that we can have that rivalry, and we're not going to hate our competitor like they sometimes do in football and basketball.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that's, even I know for ourselves, like our arch rivals at Carnegie Mellon is Washington University of St. Louis or the University of Chicago or Emory. And yet I'm extremely good friends with those various coaching staff, and we want to beat them. But when I get with Jeff Stiles from Wash U, we are constantly asking about each other's family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we can be competitors and yet still enjoy that competition with each other.
And does that same coaching kind of friendliness transfer over internationally, or not so much?
Yeah, I, again, for me, it's maybe a little bit different because me being here at Carnegie Mellon, it's a NCAA Division III school. And so I don't live in that personal coaching realm. I don't live in that D1 realm on a daily basis like a number of the other coaches may. And so it's a little bit different for me. I've gotten to know some of the foreign coaches. But again, it's, you know, there's no hostilities. You're just there and you're out at the warm-up track and you're watching what they're doing and they're watching what you're doing. And, you know, it works out well.
Yeah, I mean, being honest, they have to be looking at the guy who's coaching the gold and silver medalist. They have to be kind of watching and wondering and following your training routines and really, I don't know, just really curious about what you're doing with these guys.
Yeah, well, and let's just, what we want to do too, Mark, though, is me as the USA men's throwing coach, what that basically means is I'm not there working personally with Ryan or Joe every single day. Like Ryan Krauser, his real personal coach is his dad, Mitch. Joe Kovacs' personal coach now is his wife, Ashley Kovacs, who just took the job at Vanderbilt. So what I'm there is I am basically a facilitator for USA Track and Field to be able to get them information, find out what they need, get things for them to make their experience be the best experience that they can have and put them in the best position for them to be successful to go out and do what they're trying to do, and that's win a medal. You know, in some cases, like for instance, Raymond Saunders's coach is Derek Yush, the throws coach down at Alabama. He wasn't able to be at Tokyo. Well, Derek and I have been friends for 30-some years. So he and I are FaceTiming each other for during practice sessions, where even at the meet, I'm videotaping, sending him the video, and then he's coming back to me, and he's trying to watch the live feed, and sometimes it got delayed, and he's like, Gary, what did you see? And I was like, well, this is what I saw. And then the live feed would kick in, and before he could say it, he'd go, yes, exactly. Just tell Raven what you just said to me. That's exactly what I'm thinking, too. And so that's where I felt like I was actually maybe coaching. But my true job is I'm a facilitator and trying to give and get these guys in the best possible position for them to be successful in what they're trying to do.
Oh, that's really interesting. I think a lot of listeners and aspiring athletes out there will be curious to hear that. You know, like, this is how Olympic coaching works, and it's more like a facilitation.
Exactly. Yeah, because they all have their own personal coaches that they're with on a daily basis, you know? And so, like, for Raven and Derek, I was there to be able to fill in. Or, like, for instance, Curtis Thompson, one of our javelin throwers, his personal coach is Tom Putzkis. Again, Tom couldn't be there. So Tom and I had conversations before, and during the competition, I'm there going off of what Tom had said to me and what he thinks, Curtis, and then I'm texting him, and, you know, and so you build those. And the nice thing for me is a lot of these guys, because I've been doing this now for basically 11 years, a lot of the guys have been on the same team as I have for a number of times. And so it makes that, like, Rudy Winkler and I, our first team together was back when he was a junior in high school for the world championship team in Barcelona, Spain. So I basically have known Rudy for 9 years, and I've watched him to develop and grow, and, you know, so it's worked out really well.
Yeah, and it's a successful recipe, obviously, you know, to have that collegiality and be in good communication with all the coaches. Obviously, it's proven successful because U.S. track and field was very successful in this Olympics, and in your area and throwing especially. Maybe you could just highlight any successes or any challenges that you especially, you know, that were especially highlights for you and in this Olympics.
Well, obviously the success of Ryan and Joe is just unparalleled in the men's shot put. But the thing that was really interesting, we were really a very young team in the grand scheme of things. And I think the thing that was most exciting for me was to see some of the young kids go through the trials and tribulations of maybe not performing as well, you know, performing really well at the trials, then maybe not performing as well at the Olympic Games themselves, but them not, it's like, hey, I only got to wait 3 more years. I'm going to be even more ready. And so it's that whole attitude is very similar to what we talk about at a Division III Carnegie Mellon level. And so coaching is coaching, and athletes are athletes. It's just your perception of where you are. And so I'm sure these guys, when they were sophomores and juniors in high school, the perception of their state meet was, this is the biggest competition I'll ever be in my life.
Yeah, right.
Well, now they can look back maybe 10 years later and go, that wasn't the biggest competition, but it's the perception of where you are and what you're doing that allows you to have those anxiety moments and things like that. And that's where someone like Ryan and Joe, they have learned how to deal with them so very well. And I think that's what we got to continue to do as our, you know, for me, I'm 61 years old, the kids, you know, because they're all, you know, mostly all under 30 years old, they're kids to me, is as they grow and mature and develop, that's one of the things, the perceived, you know, experience that they're having. And once they realize that, hey, the Olympic Games, yeah, but you know what, I did it at the trials, that perception is, I can carry that over here. And that's where I think we'll do even better than what we did. I mean, and we at USA Track and Field, we say it and we believe it. We are the number one track and field team in the world. And that is shown every single time we go out and compete with the total medals and the gold medals that we earn. And that still held true here at the Olympics. It held true in Doha and in Rio. And, you know, it continues to be what we are about. And that is our goal. Is the world catching up to us? Yeah. Why? Because many of those athletes in the world, where are they living and training? They're living and training right here in the United States. They're in our college systems. Mm. And so we've got to keep on working and being better than the rest of the world.
You know, that's an incredible reflection for young athletes. You know, just that idea that perceived, no matter what the stage,
yes,
yeah, what you're perceiving is, you know, it's just another challenge. You're still, yes, on the same, the track is still the same length. You know,
yeah,
you're just growing.
That's exactly right. You know, it kind of goes back to that, you know, the movie from Hoosiers where Gene Hackman took out the tape measure and he measured how far it was for the basket to the floor and to the foul line. It's all the same. It doesn't change just because you're there at the state, you know, the state championship game. You know, well, the circle is still 7 foot in diameter. And Dane Miller from Garage Strength, he's the one that I stole that perception of that experience from.
Hmm.
You know, so I'll give a shout out to Dane on that one for sure. But I think he's exactly on the money for what we're looking at.
Well, you're an enthusiastic and great example of being able to share that lesson with young people and with Olympians now. I hope that you have lots more.
Appreciate that, Mark. Thank you so much.
And I do want to close out with a personal question for you, because I know,
sure,
you shared with me off air, I know that you are a proud father now of a collegiate athlete, of a distance runner at that. What does that change of perspective like for you? How's that different, having your daughter as a college runner?
Yeah, that's it's pretty unique. It was a lot easier. My son just graduated college, and he was a baseball player. So that was a little bit easier. But again, it was worked out really well because he was very much into the science of hitting, and so we would videotape all the time. My daughter's a little bit more on the artsy side of things as a distance runner. So she doesn't, even though she wants to be a physician's assistant, she doesn't have that interest in studying film of her running. She just goes out and runs. And it is unique. It's funny because I often tell kids, don't take this the wrong way, that my daughter is not running for me, because she actually goes to my alma mater and runs for one of my best friends. He was an usher in my wedding. And I said, but don't look at that. I say, would you want to be with your dad for 4 straight years every single day of your collegiate career? And that usually kind of, no, but she's running for one of my best friends, which is kind of a unique situation at times too. But yeah, it's a great thing, especially being at my alma mater. Where I had a great deal of success. She is forging her own path. And again, the thing that is great is her being a distance runner, she doesn't have to live in my shadow, even though I do cast a much bigger shadow than she is.
physically, you know,
but
yeah.
she can make her own path, and she's doing that. And, you know, we go through the trials and tribulations with her. She's had some issues with low ferritin levels. And, you know, so, yeah, it's I'm a father, but also I still am a coach. And so I'm dealing with those things as a coach would for my daughter. And, you know, but it's a lot of fun. And as the kids said, they're like, Coach, sure seems like our schedule's changed an awful lot over the last couple of years. I'm like, what do you mean? Seems like we're going to a lot of meets where Slippery Rock's at. And I'm like, well, I think we are, though. I think I did that on purpose, to go where my daughter's at so I could see her as well as being able to coach.
Oh, that's great. Well, I definitely wish her the best of luck in her first year
there.
And So grateful that you guys are out there doing good things, and that you'll continue to do so. And I hope to we can keep following you and the future teams that you work with. And it's been really a pleasure. I learned so much about throwing, and some of the inside track on the Olympics was so cool to hear. So we're very grateful for
Well,
that.
again, I thank you, and I think it's a great thing. And if I could, just allow me, for the young kids out there, just follow the love of the sport. Don't try to do this because you want to get a scholarship or you want to make a living. Do it because you love it and dedicate yourself. Put the time and effort into learning about what you're trying to do. One of the great things about coaching here at Carnegie Mellon is that these kids are brilliant in their academic world as engineers and computer scientists and things like that. But they have that analytical mind, which for me as a throws coach is great, and it allows me to have incredible discussions with them about the science of it, and they understand it. And it shows that their love for it is more than just picking up something and throwing or just trying to jump far. Love what you're doing, then it doesn't become hard to do. When it's on a, hot summer day and you're trying to go out and throw, go throw. Get out there and throw, not because you have to, it's because you want to get out there and throw and see how much better you can get. So, I hope the kids listening take that to heart, that do it because you love it and continue to get that love of the sport and what you're doing. Try to find ways to keep on making that grow.
And once again, that's awesome advice. And when you say kids, people listening, that means anyone out there that's young enough to still be running or throwing, be that college, high school,
Exactly.
aspiring amateur athlete, that
Very
includes
much.
all of us. I need that advice too.
Yeah,
So.
that's it's one of the things, as my father says, intelligence comes with age. Not really. It's just like, oh yeah, Dad was kind of right. I never thought he was right, but he was right when he said things to me when I was a younger person, So now that I'm getting older, I realize my father was pretty smart when he said things,
Yeah, I can relate. I can relate. Well, I once again, Coach Aldrich, so grateful for your time, and best of luck this
Thank you.
season there. And I hope to see you at a track event or a championship sometime soon.
Sounds great, Mark. I really appreciate it, and it's a great thing you're doing and putting podcasts out. And I checked out the website, and I thought it was awesome. I really liked it a lot.
Thank you
So,
so much, Gary. That means a
no
lot.
problem. All
All
right.
right.
Well, thank you.
Yep. Take care, and have happy throwing.
Thank you. You too.
All right. Take care. Bye bye. And thank you for tuning in to the Running Anthropologist podcast. It has been an exceptional Olympics, to say the least. I'm so grateful that we were able to follow it and bring a little bit of that Olympic spirit to you in the podcast. Reached out to a lot of track and field coaches, and was super happy that Coach Aldrich was willing to do this, and just for his time and for all the things that he puts back into the track and field world and all the goodness that's out there. I'm so grateful for him, and also grateful for you and all that you do in giving back in small ways. If you have things that you want to share with us, or people that are doing inspiring things, please reach out. We'd love to talk to them. It's not just about the big events, but about the small things that make running and athletics and movement magical. We do a lot with movement as medicine and movement as therapy, and it's cool to see people on the Olympic stage just putting it out there and doing their best and really bringing the best of international collaboration and culture. And I love seeing it every chance I get. And I hope that you did too, or that you caught a few of your favorite events in the Olympics. If you want to reach out to us and share some of those, you can do so on our blog site, runninganthropologist.com, or on our Facebook page, or on Instagram at runninganthropologist. And until next time, we wish you and yours happy running. And until then, we'll be covering in the next episode some local running shops, some local running culture, and just getting their perspective. So I look forward to sharing that with you in the next episode. Thanks for being with us. Happy running and throwing.